You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello. And welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 118, a brief overview of post-conquest Latin American history, part 3, post-independence conflict. Last time we dealt with the independence of Spanish America, with the exception of the Caribbean, and the differing path which Brazil took to the same place. So today we'll continue on to the next stage of the story. The post-independence years. The rebels had won. They were independent. But what kind of state were they going to create to replace colonial rule? And given how large and disconnected Spanish America was, how unified or disunified would it be? These two questions would form the basis of the extreme turmoil which defines the coming decades. Similar to those debates which we saw taking place in Spain last episode, there was discord about whether the newly independent countries should be modern and liberal, or whether they should try to revert to something approximating the old system, but with a new local leader replacing the Spanish royal family. Tied into this, in complex ways, was the question of how centralized or federalized the new territories should be. Should they be large or small? And should they have a strong central government to direct them, or a loose system which empowered local leaders? Let's look at that second question first, as the questions surrounding liberalism versus conservatism will persist long after the borders of the new countries have largely been settled. It will bleed into the topics which we will look at in the latter part of this episode, and the coming ones. As I mentioned, these two questions were intertwined in complex ways, making it difficult to completely separate them out. For ease of understanding, however, I think they need to be looked at individually. As we've seen, the independence leaders had liberated what are today multiple countries. Bolívar believed that they would be stronger together. He wanted all of Spanish South America to unite into an enormous country which would have the population and resources to establish a powerful position in global geopolitics. He gave hints that in his ideal world, Central America and Mexico might join this envisioned union, but his focus was primarily on South America. This proved to be challenge enough in itself. Others took a much more local perspective. Bolívar died unhappy, broken, and on his way to exile, as the local leaders of the constituent parts of the land he had liberated fought against each other and declared themselves to be independent states. Largely, countries formed based roughly on the borders of the pre-independence Spanish governorships, those units which together had made up the viceroyalties. This wasn't always the case, however. Parts of Colombia tried to break away from Bogotá, for example. New Spain was slightly more complex as well. Mexico remained united, despite being made up of smaller governorships and attempts by the Yucatan to break away. Central America broke away from the old viceroyalty, and Chiapas, then the most northern state of Central America, eventually switched to become Mexico's most southern state. There were numerous factors undermining unity. Most obvious was the geography. Spanish America is vast. Many of its countries today, despite having split from the larger viceroyalties, are still enormous and difficult to run. On top of this, Many are riven by huge natural barriers, which again still make unifying them difficult at times today, but were even more difficult to overcome in the age when horses, wind and oar-powered boats, or simply walking were the means of transport. The Amazon rainforest, for example, was a huge barrier, which occupied parts of many of the newly independent countries. But other jungles, such as those on the Caribbean coast of Central America and the Pacific coast of Colombia, also impeded connection. Then there were the Andes, which could be crossed, but very slowly. There are plenty of other mountain ranges which posed a similar problem, such as the one which spans southern Mexico and Guatemala, or the Sierra Nevada in northeast Colombia. Deserts like the Atacama in northern Chile and southern Peru were also difficult to traverse, and elsewhere, marshes cut towns like Mompox in Colombia off from terrestrial travel to the outside world. Politically, unification was difficult as well. Of course, local elites had a motivation to preserve their autonomy and power, but this wasn't necessarily insurmountable. Fragmentation was built into colonial structures, however. Spain itself was a delicate composite of old kingdoms and peoples, something it still struggles with today, as evidenced by Catalonia's independence movement and the militant Basque separatist campaign of the 20th century. The old Habsburg system, where each colony traded more with Spain than with its neighbours, had also bred a disjointed empire. The Bourbon reforms had given new autonomy to certain governorships, and it was these places which tended to break away from the old viceroyalties. Examples include Ecuador, Bolivia, Paraguay, and the Central American countries. All of this led to the viceroyalties falling apart, but provided neat units for them to break into. It wasn't just a simple case of nation forming, however. Within those nations, the regionalists argued with the centralists as well. As already noted, Colombia is an example of a country of which parts did try to break away, in this case without success. Central America was actually united as one at times, but here the regionalists did succeed, and to oversimplify enormously, this is why it is divided into smaller states today. Even the federalists, who were happy to remain within a country, would often fight for greater autonomy for their region. This argument about federalism and centralism did not fit neatly along the lines of the other dispute between liberals and conservatives, which is why I say that the two questions were intertwined in complex ways. At different times and different places, liberals could advocate either position to advance their vision for the country. The same is true of the conservatives. So let's look at that second conflict in more detail. We today are used to the idea of liberals and conservatives fighting. It is tempting to apply our own assumptions based on our current reality to the subject then. There are indeed some ways in which you can map these understandings of the meaning of the labels onto this dispute. The conservatives did want to conserve, and the liberals wanted to enact new ideas which they thought would make for a better society. This impulse is encapsulated in another present-day word for liberal, progressive. It suggests the idea that those of the left want to enact progress towards a better society. This idea has its roots in the era in question. The terms left and right wing come from which side of the French Parliament at the time of that country's revolution a politician sat. So while their positions in relation to each other might be the same, what the conservatives were trying to conserve and the vision of the liberals do not neatly match our understandings today. To progress away from the old order then meant opposing feudal-derived structures based on a monarch with absolute power, a nobility given land by that monarch, and a strong church. These are the institutions which the conservatives believed provided order and meaning to society, and which they sought to conserve. The conservative position of today actually contains many elements which made up the liberal position then. Free trade and the rights of the individual, not to have their freedom curtailed by state power, today the government but then a king, are pretty standard parts of the modern conservative position. While conservatives in the USA might oppose social changes in the form of identity-based issues, there aren't many who call for a king to impose order. In Europe, and using the UK as an example, where we do have a king, conservatives might be deferent to that king, but they are also often fierce proponents of liberal and neoliberal economics, as illustrated by Margaret Thatcher, and few want to hand the king back the powers which his ancestors enjoyed. An idea like communism, which sought on paper at least to empower ordinary people, would have seemed intolerably revolutionary to those liberal revolutionaries of the 19th century in Latin America. Now, some will argue that political developments in the last few years might be changing what it means to be liberal and or conservative. This is definitely a time of turmoil and rethinking, but that's beyond the scope of this podcast. My intention in making comparisons to today's political thought should be enough, however, to illustrate the point that what it meant to be conservative or liberal at the time we were examining was not the same as what those labels mean today, and that if you try to apply our meanings onto this history, you will misunderstand it. The conservatives at the time worried about the degradation of social order and believed that a strong traditional structure, usually monarchy, was needed. Some advocated creating a brand new monarchy from among their number to replace the Spanish one, or to import a king from Europe. The liberals wanted to see a constitutional rule based on free trade, the rights of man, and a parliamentary form of government. Linked to this was a question about the role and power of the church, but positions on this usually connected fairly neatly to the liberal-conservative divide, which is why I haven't categorised it as a third major question. The liberals wanted a secular society, while the conservatives wanted to empower the church. The issue did lead to bloodshed and wasn't quickly resolved. We will look at perhaps the strongest example in a future episode of this series, when priests were actively and violently attacked during the years surrounding the Mexican Revolution. Neither side really envisioned much of a social revolution based on the participation of women, indigenous peoples, Afro-Latinos, or the poor more generally, according to modern understandings of what this would entail. But the liberals did enact a couple of major changes when it came to the status of these groups. For example, in some places attempts were made to create legal equality for indigenous peoples. The liberal advocacy of liberal market economics, however, sometimes created a new set of problems. Being flung into a market economy, where technically they could rise to the top, but lacking the resources to compete with others, and facing persisting non-legal prejudice, some found their traditional lands bought up by the wealthy, and turned into new haciendas, while they struggled to make ends meet. The most major social change, however, was the end of slavery. This process was gradual, and it was completed at different speeds and in different ways across Latin America. It was inspired by a number of different factors, and the strength of these factors impacted how quickly the process took place across the various countries. While it wasn't a given that the liberal ideas surrounding individual liberty and the rights of man extended to the enslaved people in the minds of those who held them, it did in some. And so this led many on the liberal side of politics to conclude that slavery was incompatible with their views. While some of the independence leaders had stated their aim to free the country's slaves before even winning their wars, the number of people arriving from Africa often continued to grow between their victories and abolition. Another more practical consideration was that the criollos needed manpower to fight their constant civil wars against each other. In some places, freedom was given in return for military service. In South America in particular, these deals were often made during the Wars of Independence themselves. Both the rebels and the Spanish recruited, until now, enslaved people, and some of those people judged that the Spanish were more likely to uphold their deals than the independence leaders, who often owned slaves themselves. External pressure also played a part. While the British had of course been heavily involved in the trade, and this included its private merchants who had shipped slaves to the Latin American colonies which weren't under their nation's control. When Britain decided to abolish the practice, they put pressure on other countries to follow. Britain was the world's strongest power by this point, and while they couldn't force countries to end slavery, they could assert themselves on the Atlantic crossing and raid slave ships. They could also use their soft power to put pressure on other nations. Many Latin American countries abolished slavery before the USA, but when the USA did free its slaves, that put further soft pressure on those who hadn't.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Abolition broadly happened first in the countries with the smallest enslaved population, whose economies were less dependent on it. Central America started things off in 1845, with Mexico doing the same a year later. Ecuador and Bolivia were the first South American nations to enact abolition in 1851. Colombia followed in 1852, Argentina in 1853, and both Venezuela and Peru in 1854. Often the legislation did not free existing slaves, but through what came to be called free womb laws, newly born children would be free. Often compensation was paid to slave owners as redress for what was seen as their loss of property. And as with many laws in the region, enforcement in practice did not always take place uniformly as soon as the laws were instituted. The holdout countries were the Caribbean islands and Brazil, all of which relied heavily on slave labour for their plantation economies. Again, the Dominican Republic was the exception because of its unique history. When Haiti occupied them, being of course founded as a result of a successful slave rebellion, the practice was outlawed. Puerto Rico and Cuba were the last remaining Spanish colonies in the Americas, so they had no national government authorised to make the decision. Spain took the decision to outlaw slavery in Puerto Rico in 1873 and in Cuba in 1886. As for Brazil, there were slave uprisings throughout the 1800s, and there were people campaigning for the end of slavery as far back as 1822. Independence did not bring the matter to a head, however, nor did the interest taken by British abolitionists. The institution very gradually petered out over the second half of the 1800s, due in part to the fact that the rest of the world was moving on, and in part because of large-scale immigration from Europe and elsewhere, providing a new labour pool. By 1872, 15% of the population was enslaved, and this constituted a quarter of the country's Afro-Brazilian population. At that time, a free womb law had just been passed, and in 1885, another law required that slaves be freed once they reached the age of 60. It wasn't until 1888, however, that slavery was completely abolished. By that time, Brazil had become the last country in the Western world to do so, and it's estimated that 40% of all slaves taken from Africa to the Americas had ended up there. So to pick back up on that examination of those political conflicts, if you thought that liberals and conservatives are at each other's throats today, so far their arguments come nowhere near the level of ferocity as those of post-revolution Spanish America. The 1800s were marked by civil wars across the region, which lasted for decades. There are loads of these, too many to list, but I will mention a couple of good examples. In relatively small Nicaragua, the dispute was able to crystallize geographically. Today the country's capital is Managua, but the settlement was unimportant at the time, and only became the capital as a compromise. The two most important cities were León and Granada, both still the most impressive colonial cities in the country. León had developed as a hotbed of liberalism, being the first to declare independence from Spain. Granada did follow, but its criollo elite proved to be more conservative, and once independence was achieved, it formed an opposing pole to León. Individual regions across Latin America did often tend to be more conservative or more liberal in character. But this has to be one of the places, if not the place, where this divide was so neat. The two cities proceeded to fight civil war after civil war against each other. Their disunity will have disastrous consequences, as we shall soon see, with external actors taking advantage and involving themselves. Colombia was also particularly riven by liberal conservative wars. It's quite hard to separate out all of the many wars which it experienced. Initially, there were separatist wars, during which Ecuador and Venezuela broke away, and parts of Colombia tried to do the same. And in the 20th century, the political civil wars took on a more modern bent, with Marxist groups taking over the mantle of the old liberals fighting against conservative forces, something it's still experiencing to this day. In fact, you can make a case that the country has never fully been at peace for any length of time since independence. It can be hard to find a complete list of the liberal-conservative wars which marked the second half of the 19th and first half of the 20th centuries, between those other flavours of civil war. There were just so many, but among the most serious were the Thousand Day War at the turn of the century, which forms the backdrop to Gabriel Garcia Marquez's book 100 Years of Solitude, and La Violencia in the 1950s. In Mexico, the desire of the conservatives to place a monarchy in charge led to a strange alliance between them and France, who were already happy to intervene over unpaid debts. For a short period, they declared an Austrian nobleman and descendant of the Spanish king who ruled during Cortés's conquests as Emperor of Mexico. But this provided liberal republican rebels with the support they needed among those who resented foreign occupation, and he was ousted. I mentioned already in this series how many of the borders of today's Spanish-American countries correspond to those of the colonial governorships. While Latin America sometimes has a reputation in Western countries for being violent, much of that violence is due to the internal political strife we have already covered, a legacy of those old liberal and conservative wars, or due to crime. One thing you rarely saw in the 20th century were wars between states, unlike in much of the rest of the world, most notably Europe. There are still minor disputes about exact borders today, but mostly these are small scale and rarely flare up. There were notable exceptions in the 1800s and early 1900s, however, as the new states sought to define the exact extent of their borders. These could be devastating. We will look at the last few wars of the 1900s next episode, but those of the 1800s need examining here. After those initial conflicts, which saw countries break away, there was a brief period of internation peace. Within 15 years, however, several wars had broken out to define the borders of the new nations. The first was the War of the Confederation, which sort of spans the gap in categorization between those early civil wars in the wake of independence, where old viceroyalties were breaking down and the centralists were fighting the federalists, and this latter set of wars where the now established nations fought to define borders. It arose when Peru and Bolivia decided to unify into one country, and neighbouring Chile and Argentina joined rebel Peruvians who found this intolerable. It started in 1836 when the Confederation of the Two Nations was announced and lasted until 1839 when the Confederation was defeated and Bolivia and Peru became separate again. Confusingly, a simultaneous war was also taking place, which saw Argentina fighting against the Confederation in the north of Argentinian territory. One day we'll look at all this in the detail it deserves, and I will research it properly. But for now I trust the historians who say that this was a separate conflict, even though it involved some of the same participants and was fought in the same general area. The result was determined when the Peru-Bolivia Confederation lost their other war and was forced to withdraw its troops from Argentina. This helped to solidify the border between Argentina and Bolivia to where it stands today. By far the worst conflict in Latin America was the War of the Triple Alliance, which came in 1864. The roots of this one are complicated and linked to a civil war between liberals and conservatives in Uruguay, which Brazil had got involved in. This itself is linked to Uruguay's complex position as a contested border state between Argentina and Brazil, previously between Spain and Portugal. Again, we will look at this in what I imagine will be a long series at some point. But for now, what we need to know is that while there were border disputes between Spanish-American countries, the boundaries between Spanish and Portuguese South America possessed an extra level of tension due to the historic claims of the two empires. There had been conflicts already, mainly involving Uruguay, and the different countries had formed shifting alliances against each other during them. This time Paraguay was perceived as the problem, as it involved itself in Uruguayan politics, as was everyone else to be fair, and so an alliance arose between Brazil, Argentina and Uruguay to fight them. Now Brazil and Argentina were the powers in the region, but at this point Paraguay had built up an army which was much larger than both of theirs put together. It was intimidating, but in reality it was under-equipped and untrained. The five-year war was devastating for them. Although exact numbers are disputed, the highest estimates hold that by the end they had lost over half of their population and 90% of their country's men. They also claimed an area much bigger than their borders today, 40% bigger in fact, but had to give up these claims to Brazil and Argentina. The other major South American war of the 1800s was the War of the Pacific, which pitted Bolivia against Chile, with Peru being drawn in to support Bolivia. Here the area of contention was the mineral-rich desert on the Pacific coast, which at the time belonged to Bolivia. There are numerous and debated reasons for the war, but the spark was a Bolivian tax on Chilean companies operating in the area. After 4.5 years of fighting, Chile was victorious and took possession of what is now its northernmost region. This gives them a mining economy which still benefits the country to this day, and it also made Bolivia landlocked. They still resent this and claim the area. They also continue to maintain a navy, which they hope will one day take to the seas, but which is currently confined to Lake Titicaca. Finally, one more war took place across the 1860s, 70s and 80s, although this was not one between ex-colonial nation-states. There was still one remaining part of Latin America which was not occupied by Europeans, Patagonia. Once Argentina and Chile had finished with their border conflicts against the countries to their north, they turned their attention southwards. Today it makes sort of geographical sense that Chile occupies the thin strip of land between the Andes and the Pacific, even if the result is a preposterously long and thin country. At the time, though, it wasn't inevitable that they would stick to their side of the mountains. The fierce resistance of the Mapuche had kept Chile from expanding southwards, but now a hard-fought campaign began to finally conquer them. Settlers were gradually expanding southwards, and this led to retaliation from the Mapuche. The war was fierce. The Mapuche suffered greatly, but it took a long time for Chile to make the areas which they claimed safe for the settlers. There were periods of ceasefire and truce, but little by little, the Chileans did manage to push their border southwards. This sparked alarm for the Argentinians and created a race to Tierra del Fuego. Their experience was very similar to that of the Chileans. The Mapuche fought to keep them out, but gradually Argentina grew as new territory was taken. The Chileans actually provided arms to the Mapuche on this side of the Andes, while simultaneously fighting those on their side of the mountains. Towards the end of the conquests, there were even a couple of small direct skirmishes between Argentine and Chilean soldiers. In the end, the Mapuche lands became part of the two nations, and their borders were set where they stand today. The other peoples of Patagonia were also conquered, and not organizing their societies in such population-intensive, settled, and organized ways as the Mapuche, they largely died out completely in the wake of the conquests. There is, of course, still resentment among the Mapuche today, as well as lingering disputes about exactly where those borders should be in places. For the most part, though, this marks the end of the border disputes, which racked the decades after independence in South America. As I mentioned earlier, there were a couple of notable exceptions, which we'll look at as part of the next episode, alongside Northern Latin America's differing experience of these conflicts. If you've enjoyed the show and want to do something to help out, one thing which really helps new people to discover it is leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts from. If you want to get access to monthly extra special episodes, as well as the growing back catalogue, you can sign up to become a friend of the podcast for $2 per month. There's information about how to do this if you follow a link in the episode description. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done one of these things. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.